It's the first time now that Bitcoin is officially the most scarce asset on planet Earth. Most people underestimated the sheer demand that these ETFs would actually have. Privacy is a caveat of the past, and it's something that we don't really understand the value of until it fades. And when it fades, it will be very, very difficult to regain. Everyone has either heard, read, or even been close to someone who has fucked up tremendously on their Bitcoin holding. In an ideal world, you would have as close to 100% holding their own keys.
Hi Ulrich, how are you doing?
Hey man, I'm good. I'm in a pleasant mood. It's Bitcoin halving day, or the day after halving, depending on the time zone. I'm sitting in Cyprus right now, so to me, halving happened on 420. I find a little fun note on that. I'm sure Elon Musk would like it.
Yes, for me also it happened on 420, like 5:04 in the morning, something like that. Is there something special about that halving? Like, is there something you find interesting about this special halving?
I mean, I've been around for more than a decade now and involved with Bitcoin, and there's always something magical about a pre-programmed event that just runs like clockwork. I must say, for me, the special thing about this halving has basically been that I paid no attention, really. I've not stayed up late. I've not even watched the blocks get cracked and see how, is the chain still going to run smoothly, or is it all over now? Is some bug going to present itself? I did that in the past. I remember even spending like half of my day in 2020, seeing what will happen once the block actually got cracked, that would lead us into a lower block reward. So no, for me, this business as usual. I think it's astonishing to have an asset with a monetary policy that's pre-programmed and it just runs. I mean, when we see established markets right now and see how policy guided risk markets has really been, like the stock market is basically moving multiple percent based on what the Federal Reserve chairman is saying on a press conference. I find that a little in reverse order. It's supposed to be the other way around, that the market is moving and policy follows, not policy makes the market. So for me, this is astonishing. With Bitcoin, I'm pretty happy about it. Then in terms of just the halving, I mean, it's the first time now that Bitcoin is officially the most scarce asset on planet Earth. So before this particular halving, Bitcoin would actually have a higher inflation rate than gold, but now it's lower. This is amazing. This stipulates the whole idea and ideology between what Bitcoin is and what you can deem as a scarce asset. I find that very magical, almost, I would say.
And it's also interesting because the first halving, where we had the all-time high before the halving, and we also had the Bitcoin ETFs basically in the same time frame as the halving, like just a few months before that. And now we have the Hong Kong ETFs also in China. What do you expect from all of that in the next coming months, years from that?
So there's a big difference to the different variables there. You mentioned three of the ones that are of some importance here. So I don't think this particular halving would mean much, because if you think about the fact of how little of supply was actually being released into the network on a daily, monthly level compared to the already released supply, I don't think it moves the needle that much on price, actually. So the supply side is dwindling. We've known that for years. The rate of distribution gets cut in half every 4 years, but for every succeeding and subsequent halving event that takes place, the halving will have less of an effect on the total supply released into the market. So in that sense, I wouldn't call it a no burger. Of course, it has a meaning. And I think even from historical point of view, and just on a Bitcoin cycle basis that coincides also with American election cycles, it has an importance, but it has less of an importance than it did in the past. As for the ETFs, that is more demand side driven in terms of people getting onboarded to Bitcoin, people who previously were prevented in taking exposure now have accessibility to buy Bitcoin, either through their company, do it personally. They didn't want to do it before because they were afraid of tax or accounting or whatever implications, security considerations. The ETFs are sort of fixing all of those problems with just enabling you to buy Bitcoin from your bank or the normal investing tool that you're using, a brokerage. So that is incrementally higher importance for price development of Bitcoin rather than the halving itself now. I think for this year, we've had the luxury of basically having these two big narratives of, like, from August last year, people started to become very, very certain that the halving would, that the ETFs would actually be approved in the United States. And once they got approved, most people underestimated the sheer demand that these ETFs would actually have on even just the medium term. So usually, if you see ETF launches, they will always have a spike in activity. They spike up, and as they spike, interest fades a little bit over time. You can argue this has happened a little bit with the American ETFs as well, but nonetheless, you have seen consistent activity, consistent trading flow, and consistent inflow of capital. Of course, there's been the drag from Grayscale or GBTC basically selling out of their supplier. The people who are holding GBTC would sell their assets. That's naturally going to come to a stop at some point. I'm not even sure if BlackRock's ETFs actually surpassed Grayscale. I don't think they did yet, right? No, they're a little bit behind. So BlackRock is currently at 273,000 Bitcoin held, that Grayscale is at 304. So it's probably a matter of months before that flippening will happen. So naturally, Grayscale's position in the market is also dwindling.
It's interesting to see this all shaking out, and it's like the first few months, I think people expected so much of the ETFs. They thought like, oh, it's launching, and then we are instantly at 100,000, 200,000. Was this kind of expected also from your side, that we have this also sell pressure with the outflows? Was there something surprising for you in the first months?
Yes, very much so. One thing is I nailed it when I basically said that this was a Biden news event. I would say on the very short term, I was wrong on that, because basically price went up and it dwindled, like it had trouble leaving its range around the 40s for Bitcoin, and took that big hype up almost to 50, only to crash back below 40 again. So on the short term, it was a sell the news, but if you look at the ETF inflows and basically compare that to the price development of Bitcoin, I mean, it's very, very obvious that the ETF demand is probably the biggest contributor right now to price development in Bitcoin. So I would credit myself for getting that one right. What I did get wrong was, on the other hand, the Grayscale outflows. I watched, as everyone, the fee schedules coming out from each of the ETFs, and I was excited to see that there was basically going a reverse bidding war going on about getting the lowest fees, because the lowest fees would arguably attract the most capital. The most capital would attract the most trading flow, would attract more capital, would essentially be the winning ETFs. I had in mind beforehand that BlackRock would probably come out swinging. I also wrote a few articles how I think that BlackRock basically taking a swing at this. They're looking for a home run. They don't want to just bat it down the down the side. It was a real reputational risk they took on basically putting their name behind an ETF. So they were looking to win. And in hindsight, they are definitely in a position to also be the winning entity behind ETFs.
It's interesting for me also the stories that go on when I came into Bitcoin. It was in 2020. The big story was obviously MicroStrategy, and then later on with Tesla and all the publicly traded companies that came into Bitcoin. I think MicroStrategy was the first one, and then now we are like 60, 70, 80 publicly traded companies that are having Bitcoin on the balance sheet. I might get that number wrong, but there are a lot of publicly traded company already having Bitcoin. Then we have now the story also with MicroStrategy maybe making it to the S&P 500 list. We moved on to 2021, 2022, where El Salvador was also a big story with the first country. Now we have the Bitcoin ETF launch. What do you expect is like the story of the next like even 4 to 8 years? What else of adoption will come in there?
It's super difficult to tell. So one thing is actually that I would probably dispute the fact that there's a lot of publicly traded companies that hold Bitcoin. I remember seeing MicroStrategy buying Bitcoin in, I think it was late September, October 2020. And I was sort of expecting, wow, they figured this out. And subsequently, price would work in favor of MicroStrategy. And I was immediately thinking, like, one is a fool, two is a group, but three is a party. So I was like eagerly awaiting for the next ones to really join. But I think to the extent that, like, obviously no one did it to the extent that Michael Saylor and MicroStrategy did, but I'm just looking at this list now at Bitcoin Treasuries, and most of the companies that I know from this list have some actually connection to the crypto space in some way or form.
Yeah.
So basically what I'm saying there is that holding Bitcoin as an asset on your balance sheet is yet to be really adopted. I feel like Elon Musk's participation in that through SpaceX and Tesla was more of a gimmick, really, rather than it was real conviction. As much as I adore Elon Musk for many of his really, really good merits, and I think he's a net positive in terms of innovation and entrepreneurship and basically creating something the world has not seen before, I've never really enjoyed his takes on Bitcoin too much. It's like he's a little bit too quick on the judgment button there, but potentially not putting in the work in educating himself fully. But nonetheless, I think adoption is still to come. I'm very curious with what will happen now that MicroStrategy has a cost basis of their Bitcoin of 7.5 billion. And the current value of that is close to 14 right now. So they almost double up, netting 1.8x on their initial investment. This is absolutely astonishing. And if Bitcoin will continue to unfold in the way that I and many other Bitcoin enthusiasts and investors are thinking, I mean, this will be an absolute historical winning bet. The question is really, how many CFOs and CEOs would look towards Michael Saylor and think, wait a minute, that there's something going on there. We had this company that was basically totally dead, and now it's actually doing an all-time high on the stock price. I think this would be very much in the interest of a lot of people who are sitting up on potentially cash cow companies that is losing influence or lose its market share or has a limited market share with limited opportunity to grow. This is kind of a way to really leverage your vehicle. If that trend will continue, we're yet to see. I have more hope for the ETFs. I think it will take time for, so in the market, you speak always about what does news represent? Is it something that is either priced in or not? Mm-hmm. And I have a way of thinking or a mental model for that. If something is priced in on, like if it's shallow news or if like superficial, something that can easily be digested, it's very easy to determine whether is it priced in or not. But if it's something like the ETFs that basically changes the whole dynamic of the market structure in Bitcoin and the supply and demand mechanics, I think it's not something that you can really expect that will be priced in on the very short term. So I have a lot more hope that the ETFs will essentially continue to gobble up Bitcoin. I think it's a matter of time before the ETFs potentially represent maybe 5-10% of the circulating supply of Bitcoin. I think it's a matter of time before Bitcoin will eventually hit 100,000. And I think that will really ignite interest in the space. I mean, if you are a traditional investor and if you discount how Bitcoin has behaved on the very long term or look at it on a log chart, you basically see a chart that's going up and it's plummeting again and it's going up and it's going down again. That's not something that brings a whole lot of comfort to traditional investors. So I think that break with 100K would kind of, just as the previous breaks on Bitcoin, they look less and less important on the grand scheme of things, unless you look at a log chart. A break with 100K would more or less smooth out that curve and make it very obvious that Bitcoin is moving actually in a direction and not just going up and down, which is of course is also on the short term, but naturally on the longer term it's moving up.
Yeah, amazing. And I think also, I mean, for companies, it's probably also easier to buy the ETFs than to buy Bitcoin themselves, right? So the ETFs...
A lot easier. I sit in a country that has a fairly, I would say, flexible tax regime and accounting rules that are made to accommodate intangible assets. And I can just tell from my own personal experience of having a small modest holding company holding BTC on its balance sheet, it's a cause for confusion among even great accountants, not knowing fully how to basically list the asset in your accounting statements. So ETFs, it's easier. You basically buy a financial instrument. You can treat it as any other stock. There can be some tax considerations that you need to do depending on where you're sitting, but it should be really, really straightforward for most people. And I think all the considerations with basically security, I mean, everyone has either heard, read, or even being close to someone who has fucked up tremendously on their Bitcoin holding by either sending it to a wrong address, throwing the seed phrase out, sending the hard disk in a computer to the dumpster, getting hacked, getting things stolen physically. I mean, having things on exchange has a real benefit there that you don't, like it's foolproof basically. You don't need to, you're basically outsourcing all of that. Of course, you're paying a management fee to the ETF issuer, but probably money well spent for a lot of people not technically adequate enough to do it on their own.
Where does you see the future of self-custody? Because all the points that you mentioned are extremely legit. A lot of people lost Bitcoin along the way, especially in the early days. It gets better with time as products and the services get better. But we also then see on the other side stuff like FTX. It's also easier to get hacked when you're on an exchange rather than having it stored offline, because most of the crime is kind of is online. How do you see like the future going on for self-custody? Will self-custody always be like a niche thing for like people that really want to take their freedom, or can it be something where like 20, 30, 50% of the population actually holds their own key?
In an ideal world, you would have as close to 100% holding their own keys. What I'm basically seeing now is kind of hybrid solutions popping up where you can, full infrastructure, either have multi-sig or have some sort of hybrid that allows you to basically store your Bitcoin through some platform, but you are still the one responsible for the private key. I think that is potentially the future because I think a lot of the issues basically also come with convenience. And to be honest, many of the hardware wallets, I mean, they have improved over the years, but it's not like it's that they really reinvented the UX wheel there in terms of making it user-friendly. Before, my mom would be able to easily do it. I would not label it as something that is mass market appropriate. So I think, I mean, obviously there is an issue with exchanges being a honeypot, exchanges having faulty security, risk measurements, or just control functions internally. I think issues such as we've seen with, or you cannot even call it issues, but like fraud, as you have seen as with FTX or similar type platforms, is basically bringing the same kind of rigid control functions and procedures to those who are stewards of your assets. Much like you have in the traditional markets. I mean, if you're setting up an exchange or a bank, I mean, you really have to have your measurements in control. You have like a whole list of procedures and risk functions and control considerations in place before you can do anything with other people's money. And I mean, traditionally, that's not been the case for crypto because it's just not been like regulators have struggled to keep up, know what's going on. They have then issued, I want to say, very lightweight license schemes or legal frameworks that would allow people to do exchange operations or wallets, services, but without no real oversight in what they're doing, just with a label that, hey, we followed these very lightweight requirements from the supervisory authority of the government.
And so this is like, it's interesting to see. And for me, it's also interesting when we see companies evolving. We have this also like Celsius and BlockFi. It kind of gets more popular also right now as the price runs up with field finding. What's also like, maybe let's take a step back, also really interesting for me is the Coinbase honeypot, because you mentioned like the big centralization and honeypots being implemented. It's also like a big risk for Coinbase itself, because they have to invest a lot in security, I guess, when they have so much money from the ETFs, but also they are like really popular exchange. So they have, even without the ETFs, a lot of money, which will also like then get even greater than that. And most of the ETFs, as I understood it, use Coinbase. Some do self-custody, some use other exchanges. Do you see any risks for that? Is there something that you worried about?
I mean, yeah, wow. Coinbase is certainly positioning themselves well in terms of being a custody provider in the space now. Basically, 90% of the ETF. I think there's like Gemini, and Fidelity has their own solution, and then BitGo is basically what's on the market now. But I think 8 out of 11 cases is Coinbase, so it's really positioning itself as quite the potential Achilles heel, I would say. So thoughts out to Brian Armstrong. I really hope that you have your custody team on with a lot of coffee running and oats in the morning because that's a big responsibility. I certainly hope so. I mean, obviously, it's a little bit against the Bitcoin mantra, and I would hope also that that would spread out more, like more of the ETFs would potentially diversify in the future. The issue there is just that, I mean, it's a margins play. If you think about it just from the ETF point of view, I mean, the lowest price points you have right now is, I think that is Bitwise. That's the lowest priced one at like 0.2% or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. At least that's in the range, like 0.15 or 15 to 20 basis points. Top of my mind, that's the cheapest management fee. If you think about how cheap that basically is to run an operation where you store everything, you have all the measurements in place to safeguard other people's assets in a good manner, that's insanely cheap. It really is cheap. I mean, I've been part of negotiating fairly large custody agreements with the bigger suppliers such as Fireblocks or Copper or so forth. I mean, without disclosing their fee schedules, I can say that you would actually struggle getting a similar fee directly with the custody provider. So I think as basically competition arises, custody play is one of the sectors that really has faced a overhaul in terms of competition, like Fireblocks, Copper, BitGo, just to mention a few, are like behemoths now in terms of assets under management. And it's a real potential long-term cash cow. So obviously it also attracts a lot of interest from venture investors. Valuations of each of these companies are like magnitudes higher than the first custody solutions you saw going back to the previous cycle. So I'm expecting competition to increase there. I think the increase in competition will essentially lower fees over time. That's almost bound to happen. If fee schedules are going down, it means also that there will be a better reason for potentially ETFs or exchanges to not do things on their own, but just pick someone off the shelf. And hopefully not all of them will pick Coinbase, who probably have, from the list of ETFs, probably have managed to secure the best pricing schedule. I think that would be one variable. Another one would just be that they are listed on the American Stock Exchange. I mean, there's more control being listed as a stock on the American Stock Exchange. I mean, that always already comes with a lot of scrutiny. So imagine if you are a financial institution and you are now going to apply for an ETF. I mean, are you going to designate Binance, who has located God knows where on the custody part of the entity, or pick some supplier that's like a hybrid that says like, yeah, we're not fully qualified custodian because we hold your key, like you hold your own keys, but we just supply the software? Or will you just go with a supplier that's actually gone through all the scrutiny that you would face when you go on the NASDAQ exchange? I mean, that's almost a no-brainer if price schedules are even the same and potentially favorable for Coinbase. So I think before we see dynamics change, that they would probably continue to be a honeypot, and fingers crossed they have their stuff in order.
Definitely, I hope so. And it's interesting to imagine, like, maybe let's play this scenario out that there's something happening with Coinbase. Like it's also like depends on what happened. Like there can be a small thing happening where they can maybe like step in and do something about it. Maybe a lot of things happening where like a big chunk of the Bitcoin maybe even gets stolen. I mean, this would be a movie material, I think, if something like that happens, and God knows what happens there. But do you have any theory where, like, when something happens, this is there something like basically what we've seen with FTX, but in a similar scale?
I mean, you could basically say that that's a black swan event or some risk that has an extremely low probability. I think the probability of such an event happening will be lower over time. But if it happens, I mean, it's absolute devastation to the market, especially if it happens again, the granular scale that of FTX. I mean, I think a lot of investors still has not shrugged off what happened in 22 with FTX. So yeah, let's not hope we're in for a third one. We have Mt. Gox and we have FTX of a bigger magnitude situations. Obviously, a lot of other smaller exchanges are blowing up much more often, but that's not of the same importance as if you have something really almost instrumental piece of infrastructure to the industry. So yeah, if that happens, I mean, all bets off. Will Bitcoin survive it? Obviously it will. It's a resilient asset. And it's not really Bitcoin's fault that the people storing it does not have the essentially security aspects of their business or control functions of their business under control. But it's certainly something that harms Bitcoin. I mean, how many headlines didn't you see that was basically faulting Bitcoin for what happened at FTX? So let's not hope that that will never happen again. I don't think it's a big risk, but obviously I also thought that with the first lesson of Mt. Gox, that the likelihood of that happening at a granular scale again was super small. But yet it did happen.
Yeah, and it's interesting how this all evolves. And we talked a little bit about volatility also before, and you said like when bigger money, institutional money comes in, they want to see like the asset being not as volatile and seeing a directional move and not the crazy up and downs. And we've seen obviously through cycle that the volatility actually goes down a little bit with the crazy crashes when we compare it like really early on to 2012, 13, 14 to now the crashes. I mean, maybe there's something bigger coming in. When do you imagine like the volatility being slower when we hit like a million? I mean, there's always like, I even had guests on that already said that the volatility is about to get even crazier, like in the future, that we've not seen the major volatility, which does not make sense for me because when there's more money in the system, it should be more stable than that. What's your take on volatility and the outlook of that, like in the next like maybe 5, 10, even 20 years?
I don't see the argument why Bitcoin's volatility would increase now. I mean, on the short term, for sure, you have basically a volatility chart of Bitcoin being like swinging in a range, and then all of a sudden, oof, big move is happening. This is how Bitcoin is behaving. It basically trades with very little movement up and down, and then comes a move in either direction pretty rapidly, and everyone is surprised when it happens. I think volatility on like the longer scale is bound to decrease. I remember doing some modeling and even benchmarking some of my modeling to what I saw out there in the space. I was basically trying to figure out a point when Bitcoin would have the same volatility as the US dollar. I think actually the year was like 2028 or something like this based on modeling, but this is like years ago. I think that's not going to happen. I think volatility will persist for longer and for much longer probably than that. I don't know really. The more volume, the bigger the market capitalization of the entire Bitcoin network is, the less, like the more it would basically take to move the market. If you ask me, I mean, volatility is a gift for people seeking Bitcoin exposure because it, over long time frames, work in your favor. I mean, there's more up days than down days. And on the longer time horizons, Bitcoin price is increasing. So volatility is like a double-edged sword that you have to have some a certainty to, and you need to basically consider in your approach in investing and taking exposure. But really, it is something that works in your favor.
I told you a lot about 21 Bitcoin, the best place for me to buy Bitcoin directly on a Bitcoin-only exchange. But now let's talk about how to secure your Bitcoin. Once you got Bitcoin, you don't want to leave them on exchange. You want to take self-custody. You want to take responsibility of your own Bitcoin. That's why I recommend getting a BitBox. BitBox is an amazing wallet where you can not only keep your Bitcoin in a simple way, very secure, you can even create a passphrase. With that passphrase, you can basically create a hidden wallet on the device itself. Make sure to buy your BitBox in the link down in the description, and with code Robin, you even get a 5% discount. Yeah, definitely. I also think I think Michael Saylor said that in 2020, the volatility is the price you pay for the massive upside you get in the next couple of years. And it's interesting perspective to think about volatility, because obviously not everybody is scratched out for volatility. I have many friends and colleagues that were like, because it's so volatile, they were shaking off. They're like, oh, I cannot handle this. I cannot handle my portfolio going up and down that much. So then I always say, like, yeah, come in later, but pay like 5x, 10x, 20x the price. Like it's your decision. If you like Bitcoin, it's early is always better. Maybe let's come back to because you also wrote about regulatory landscape in your articles with ETFs and stuff like that. And we have a lot going on. We have the ETFs going on, but then also we have the EU saying stuff about unhosted wallets, trying to limit stuff like that. Then we have the MiCA coming in the EU. And there's a lot of things playing at the same time with Bitcoin. Where are we right now with regulatory, especially when you are like so early in there with 2012, which is impressive. How did this evolve and how do you see it right now, Bitcoin regulatory?
Regulators are always trying to keep up with innovation, right? And this has been like something, not just a new innovation or something like this, but this is like conceptually challenging existing models and existing frameworks of how you basically provide legal guidance and framework for how stuff should be, how the regulators would basically guide you and restrict you and limit you from doing certain actions, and how they would stipulate you doing others. So they're basically playing a catch-up game there. Obviously very little regulation in the beginning, when I first stumbled upon Bitcoin. Now something else. Is still not to a point where regulators can really encapsulate everything that's going on. I think with the ETFs, that's basically a big stamp of approval on Bitcoin as an asset class. It's basically the SEC also ruling out Bitcoin, being a security. It's also a big step because it's not a security, yet even those arguments were made earlier. So where is it? Where is the regulatory environment moving? I think it's a little bit of a pendulum. I fear that in the wake of FTX and everything that went on there, that potentially the regulatory swing is swimming too much in the direction of regulatory action. And the issue with a regulator, I'm saying they're playing a catch-up game, but the reason is that they're playing a catch-up game is natural, right? They cannot be on the forefront of innovation. If so, they would be innovators, and they're definitely not innovators. They are they're trying to encapsulate what is going on in the innovation space in the world. When things happen in the market, regulators are forced to take action. So when you have devastating things, or you have news stories, or when basically just the stakes get higher, market capitalization is, much like Bitcoin, also only going in one direction. And this is for the entire crypto industry, also only moving in one direction. So the higher the stakes, the bigger the risk also. So I think it's only natural that regulators really trying everything in their power to do this. What I could fear is, as I was saying, that the pendulum would basically always swing in the direction of that they try to play catch up too quickly for something they do not understand fully yet. It's almost better to be a little hesitant and try to guide the markets as well as you can, not to overregulate and trying to put up frameworks that doesn't make sense for the industry, because it's clearly written by someone who doesn't know what's going on. This I could fear a little bit could be going on, but I mean, we are here to see, right? We also have like a CBDCs being a thing. I mean, I remember seeing the first test cases of that being rolled out in 2019 and 2020. That's still not something that you see on a granular scale in the Western world being rolled out. But I assume basically that there is a plan in place to eventually replace the fiat money that is in existence right now with digital currency, like real digital currency, with unique footprints, which basically what CBDCs are. So with that coming into play, I think regulators will more or less try to box in what a CBDC is with what a lot of different cryptos are. They will probably struggle with that because, I mean, I think the bigger offices in the States, like the CFTC and the SEC, has basically now faced that not all digital assets are born equal. I'll probably claim that 90% of them are more or less just like securities. There's some team that had an idea, they put the innovation out there. If you invest or buy the token, you're basically, like, the team will basically benefit from that. And you as a token holder is basically benefiting from the team's performance. So it doesn't really pass the Howey test in that sense. But a lot of them are also something like hybrids or something in between. Is it a commodity? Is it like a hybrid asset between a commodity and a security, where aspects of that are like crossovering? Your question was what will happen and what do I expect? I mean, it's very difficult to know. I try to really not get in the minds of regulators at this point. I've been wrong so many times thinking what will happen. I thought basically that the hammer would come down crushing hard on Bitcoin before ETFs were basically approved. That didn't happen. I mean, there are some worrying signals in terms of self-custody now. I noticed some exchanges are now being forced to basically do certification from what's called travel rules. So essentially, if you withdraw an amount larger than, I think the threshold is like $10,000 or 10,000 euros or something like this, and you do it to a self-custody wallet, you have to basically sign a box with the exchange saying this is sent out to me, so that they can basically label that, like, that is basically mapping out the decentralized network, right? That they are mapping out wallet addresses in your name. So that's something not seen in the past. I think basically these like there will be a war on self-custody solutions more and more. I think identification is something regulators will really seek more of in the market.
Is this KYC and as you describe it right now, kind of an attack on Bitcoin? Or just like an try to make the new system compatible with the old system?
You could claim so, because I mean, the initial idea is a peer-to-peer electronic money. I mean, when I hand you a 50-euro bill, there's no lock storage or identification of the two entities that basically did that exchange. That's the idea of bringing that digital, making it unique, while having a monetary policy that was scarce. I mean, yeah, I see it a little bit as an attack, because it's an attack on privacy, and it's an attack on privacy that is not fully. I mean, the exchanges, if you transfer, let's say you transfer an ungodly amount to exchanges, you transfer from, you open a new exchange account and you send 100 million worth of Bitcoin to that exchange immediately. I think it's fair that the exchange as a central counterparty is basically doing source of funds on that money for them, because they have a regulatory regime they have to fall under and do their due diligence. But when you're sending out your money, I don't think it's fair to basically ask for the same kind. Like, this is just my general opinion on the AML, which is what it essentially is, AML policies, that I don't think it's fair that you do the same kind of scrutiny on money going out as money coming in. So I don't get that. I mean, if you wish to hold your Bitcoin off any centralized counterparties, I mean, you should be happy to do so without taking extra measurements, and because that's the whole idea. You own the asset, right? It's the same kind of stupidity happening when I hear now that banks are very, in Denmark, which is my country of origin, I mean, there's now a rule in place with a limit of 2,000 euros. You can basically withdraw cash from the bank of amount 2,000 euros. If you do it, or if you wish for more, you basically have to do a self-assessment or basically tell the bank where how you're going to spend that capital. They also enforce laws, as far as I know, that even if I'm to buy a used car from you, I can also only pay you in cash 2,000 euros. Everything above that in the sales sum of the car, I would have to do via wire transfer. So, I mean, it's obvious that there is a demand for greater control over money spent, and that trickles down into the crypto economy as well.
It's for me, as you described, it's sad to see, because honestly, when someone buys a car from someone else, a used car for, like, I don't know, 15,000 euros, it's none of your business why, like, this is, you should not, like, the state should
that's
not
an, that's an honest transaction between two human beings that should not face scrutiny. And I mean, if they didn't have a problem with your money being on the account and the way you earned it, how can they have a problem with the way they pull it out? And I mean, the banks are not fully to fault there. The banks are basically just extending the policy of the states and the financial regulators. So, I mean, you could argue that banks are more or less to the same degree bureaucrats as the state is, but that's another story. That's more a political viewpoint on my end, but at least they are really, yeah. Control is something they crave more. Identification is something they crave more. Privacy is something they wish to elude and basically remove from the transactional flow between humans and entities. This trickles down into crypto. You've seen all the major privacy coins, they already got delisted and banned and whatnot from various centralized exchanges. And that's basically because they pose a super big issue on this particular aspect of anonymity and privacy, because you can basically not do put the Chainalysis or Elliptic software down on the chain and follow, okay, if we've identified this wallet, how have you then spent the pattern afterwards. So, yeah, it's a real issue. I fear it as a theme for the future, basically, also just taking it broader out from money, but also how the internet is used, how information is conveyed, how surveillance is now increasing. Privacy is a caveat of the past, and it's something that we don't really understand the value of until it fades. And when it fades, it would be very, very difficult to regain.
Yeah, that's I like that sentence a lot. And when we think of, as we said also with CBDCs, a lot of interesting discussions already on the podcast about CBDCs. And I even had one guy on that said like CBDCs are exactly a Trojan horse for Bitcoin, because the governments are saying this digital wallet has value, and introducing basically the masses to something digital. And then the jump to Bitcoin, as people see it as the better store of value, because CBDCs still have a bad monetary system. Like it's still not, like it's not better than fiat in that regard from a monetary aspect. At least I don't think so.
It's worse.
It's even worse, yeah. And then people have a natural flow towards Bitcoin when they already are introduced by governments in a mass way to a CBDC.
See, this is also the interesting part. And you asked me for what was some of the surprises I've had. I've had a surprise with Bitcoin, and that's basically been how slow the adoption has been. I mean, you can argue that potentially the amount of Bitcoin users is kind of like plus 50% yearly or something. Like I've seen some estimates that is the count. That's super difficult to measure, by the way. But let's just go with that number. Let's say it's just double-digit growth on Bitcoin adoption every year. I have been astonished how the flipping point of Bitcoin is yet to really be here. You can argue that it's potentially now, that this is now essentially finally that point at the S-curve adoption where things really take off. But I think just there's so many things going on in the world that really like unfunded wars, inflation, government spending, privacy attacks, issue with like sovereign ownership of asset, like your self-ownership of assets. I mean, there's so many trends in society basically pointing towards this particular phenomenon, which Bitcoin really is. And it has been my surprise that the real tipping point or the real ignition of Bitcoin has not really happened yet. It's still a niche phenomenon. It's still only valued at like 10% of gold, which I think is like hysterical. You have assets out there, like big stocks, big individual companies that are worth more than the entire Bitcoin network. That is ridiculous, if you ask me, that like Bitcoin should be worth so much more. But that's just something I'm puzzled about. I mean, investment theory would also say, or a good old saying there is like, you can be right, but your timing might be wrong. I mean, like potentially we're all right about Bitcoin, but that particular tipping point is only like 10 years away or 20 years away. I think it's very natural to overestimate what will happen in just a few years' time. And then you maybe lose track of the bigger picture if you really look out a decade or two in the past, or even like a generation out in the past, in the future, sorry.
Yeah, definitely. And it's also interesting for me when we look at adoption and when you come in, you always have this like, oh shit, I figured this out like this and I have to buy so many Bitcoins now, because what if and tomorrow everybody figures it out? Like you have this fear of like missing out all of the sudden. But then you come in and then you see it like, oh, it's not that fast. Oh, the world is still going around and is still going as usual. And when you talk with friends, they're having a lot of interesting or stupid opinions on Bitcoin, why they don't want to buy it. I mean, my environment got really orange pilled, really Bitcoinified. It's hard for me to find people that are completely outside of Bitcoin. Even my family is warming up a lot to Bitcoin. But yeah, I've been talking about it 4 years now, so it's like not a representative family, I guess. But for the general population, I still believe the pain is just not big enough. Is it that like this that people are not struggling enough?
That's a fair argument that things have to really hurt before you're willing to look for an an alternative. I mean, in a sense, the internet is doing a lot for information flow. Like it's possible for anyone anywhere to educate themselves about any topic as long as they have an internet connection. And I think the like just the issue around say government stipulated monetary policy, inflation as a theme, is something that I think the general public is really being aware of. I mean, I'm 32 years old, and like the last couple of years is the first time where I've really like noticeably felt inflation firsthand in my lifetime. And I think a lot of people have actually felt that in on their lives. I think that is basically craving or posing questions for people, and the questions are very easy to answer if you're willing to put in, I mean, just a handful of hours and educate yourself using just YouTube, Google, like whatever sources you find natural for getting the information.
Definitely. And it's impressive that you got Bitcoin since 2012. Just like how did you get it so early? Like, I mean, for me, it was hard because like I was just, I think, 13 or 14 years old. But how did you get Bitcoin in 2012?
I regrettably, I cannot really remember how the concept of Bitcoin popped up. I think it was a friend of mine that discovered it first on the internet or something like that. And at that time, I mean, we were already deep down. I think when was the first Zeitgeist movie, the first one? I'm interested to see that. That's like 2007, 2008. Okay, so basically, I think a lot of the questions and the contrary thinking and like the critical thinking came with those first Zeitgeist movies. That makes sense. That came to a question of basically monetary policy, and out of that spawned a technological phenomenon. And I've always been a somewhat of a nerdy fellow. You know, I've interested in technology, interested in technology trends, what's going on, tinkering with computers since I was very small. So seeing like a technological phenomenon trying to solve a financial issue or like a structural issue for society, it was quite interesting. Much like anyone else that discovered Bitcoin early, I obviously did all the same mistakes of having Bitcoin. Basically, not buying enough was the first issue. I didn't have a lot of money at the time, so I didn't really have the capacity to even do so. But and then essentially just selling it too early. And I completely faded it when Mt. Gox blew up. I was like, fuck this. This is the end of it. This is not supposed to happen. I remember really feeling anger and frustration when that happened. And then I basically just left it alone for a few years, which was arguably the second biggest mistake. Like leaving the space from probably 2013 until mid 2016. Then all of a sudden I checked in on it every now and again, but it was like slumping around, like Bitcoin is dead, whatever. It's not moving around. And you can say anything. I mean, I could also stay on top of what was going on in the community, but the Bitcoin price is really also in some sense a health indicator, because it shows the interest in the underlying asset of the protocol. I faded it then and came back in mid end 2016 when things started to move again. And then I didn't leave since, essentially. Like I was part of the journey since, set up an asset manager in 2017. That essentially turned into me relocating to Cyprus and setting up an investment fund. I exited that fund later in 21, sold my shares, or parted ways with the company. Then since then, I've just been like private venture builder and investor in the space. I'm now involved with a payments a fintech startup called Peanuts, where we're basically trying to solve some of the issues we just covered here with banking. I mean, it's not like we're not like running below regulatory frameworks and stuff like this and need to follow the same AML and KYC guidelines. But essentially what we're trying to build is like a financial hub where the customer acceptance policy is not set in stone, where there's different shoes for different feet for a reason. And this is how we try to model our system as well. So basically what we do is that we integrate with a number of different financial institutions. And based on the ones that basically have are good with e-commerce or accept e-commerce or accept crypto businesses or accept retail clients doing crypto transactions or whatever, we can basically have a like supply the full customer facing application with all the middleware, but all the plumbing is basically different for each individual entity based on their needs and what they're really looking for. So this is what I'm building right now, and very involved with digital assets in general. My heart and passion is a lot with investing also. So I'm also investing in as an angel investor and doing wealth advisory and investing in early stage projects and funds and basically spending a lot of time on what's really going on in the industry. Right now, I'm very interested in what's going on in the whole Bitcoin ecosystem, because the longer I've stayed in the space, the more I kind of gravitate towards Bitcoin. I remember in 2016-17, I became like an ultra Ethereum supporter and thinking, Ethereum is great because it kind of solves all of these problems with scalability and smart contracts that Bitcoin didn't, Bitcoin basically didn't have the capacity for. Then as time has progressed, I've kind of, I would not say left that alone, but I have like designated or developed my mental thinking so that it's not really a catch-all. There's not really one winning project in the entire industry. It's like multiple different sectors in the industry. I think the killer one for that is basically Bitcoin. So Bitcoin is probably going to attain the biggest market share for a long time of the entire market. Ethereum would be probably one of the winning ones in the smart application framework and offering a hub for decentralized applications. But I'm very interested in what's basically going on in the Bitcoin ecosystem now, with basically people, it felt a lot since last year that Bitcoin really had a reignition on what is going on in the Bitcoin ecosystem. People trying to basically build side chains, services, lending protocols, custody platforms, wallet solutions around Bitcoin. I'm very interested in that and have also placed a few strategic bets on that, but with part of my portfolio. So very excited to see where that will be headed. So far it's looking like that is one of the, I think that's going to be one of the narratives of this also bull market. If people are looking for alpha, I think that is one of the probably bigger alpha plays that is taking basically a leveraged Bitcoin bet through various types of infrastructure in and around Bitcoin.
Yeah, definitely. Bitcoin industry is like that's the place to be when you want to be in something really cool in the next like 5 to 10 years. It's also interesting, as you mentioned, Tsipras, really quick before we come to the end of the podcast, what's your thoughts around El Salvador adopting Bitcoin, like the first now, what has it been, 3 years, I think, since they officially announced it?
Mm-hmm. I mean, regrettably, I've not yet put my feet on the ground in El Salvador. That's something I hope to achieve end of the year. Before end of the year, I would like to visit El Salvador. I think it's really bold move I see El Salvador political regime receiving a lot of scrutiny, especially now from the IMF lately. I'm not sure that the day-to-day adoption among the population has really gotten a hold, and I'm not sure it will for the foreseeable time. But basically just removing the fraction, or not fraction, friction, removing the friction towards basically adopting Bitcoin and integrating Bitcoin in the monetary system, I think it's astonishing. Much like what we discussed earlier, I had the same exact feeling when El Salvador, or when it was announced at the Bitcoin conference that El Salvador is now adopting Bitcoin. I had the same feeling as when MicroStrategy took their first buy and made it public, put it on Bitcoin on the balance sheet, that wow, did the next country will now likely come. I mean, there's been some meaningful attempts to that. I don't think anything as significant as El Salvador, but I'm actually astonished that there's no more public announcement of sovereign nations basically buying Bitcoin. I hear a lot of rumors of basically countries in the Gulf potentially taking a stab at Bitcoin. That could be either UAE, Qatar, Oman, or Saudi, but it's not something that's really been publicly disclosed. You could argue that if you're in the process of accumulating Bitcoin, you don't really want to publicize that. But yet, I feel if a bigger nation actually did make it public that they were in the process of adopting Bitcoin, or even just accumulating Bitcoin as part of the national reserve, I think it would be do wonders for price appreciation. I think it would do wonders for adoption. I think it will take us to like close to 100K, like in a matter of a week, 2 weeks. It needs obviously to be a significant nation, but I've been astonished that again, that there has been no follow-ups on that in a significant way. I'm very bullish on the, like, just looking from afar. As I said, I've not had feet on the ground in El Salvador, but I'm extremely bullish on just the general statistics I can see. I mean, it went from one of the most dangerous places on planet Earth to be, with murder rates, criminal rates, abduction rates, all these nasty statistics just being in the very severe end of that, to being in the very low end of that. I don't think that's obviously has to do with more stricter control and more imprisonments and stuff like this, and not so much with Bitcoin adoption. But I think it basically tells a story of a country that is really doing a 180 in terms of everything. And I think sometimes you need to be like, have the risk willingness, like to see change, you also have to risk something. I think the old Chinese saying is that if you did as you did yesterday, you can expect what happened yesterday, something like that. And I think that's very true. I think political regimes globally are sometimes too afraid of risk, afraid of changing the status quo in order to see real change, or with even having the potential of real change. Politics in modern world is sort of like having a budget, a financial budget, and then dividing that in different buckets. We have healthcare here, we have infrastructure here. Here's the tax rate, it goes up and down, and depending on what political party is getting elected, they would kind of like just tinker on all of these variables in some way or form, but it's not really producing real change. I think El Salvador is a good example of the fact that real change can actually happen. I think they are not yet at a place where they are really harvesting the fruits. You could argue that they are harvested the first small fruits of their efforts with criminal rates going down and so forth. But I think we need to see them win in a big way before, much like, as I said before, with MicroStrategy. I mean, MicroStrategy, once they, let's see them make 10 plus billion, 15 plus billion on their Bitcoin bid. That's when I think it will shake eyebrows around the world. And I think the same will happen for El Salvador if they really change their nation.
Definitely. And El Salvador has the advantage to be actually one of the stories that kind of started on the bottom. Like, they had the highest murder rate, they had not a lot going on for them. And if this can be, even though it's a small country, smaller than Austria, it can be one of the highlight stories as a role, serving as a role model for other nations that are in a similar situation. Like, obviously it will not be like America is then taking that example of El Salvador, but it will be maybe like a small country that also has problems that taking the example of El Salvador. And yeah, Nayib Bukele is also like doing, I think, a good job of one, signaling to the outside what's actually going on, and also inside doing a good job in bettering the country. Obviously, I also have not been there, but I have spoken on the podcast with, I think at this point, 6 or 7 people that actually live in El Salvador. So I think I have a better and better grasp of what's actually going on. And I think in November, there's a Bitcoin conference there. If everything is going as I plan, I will be there, and I'm really looking forward to check out the country.
What's the conference? Was it Pacific Bitcoin? Was it a Bitcoin festival or something like this?
I think it's called Adopting Bitcoin, but I could be wrong.
Adopting Bitcoin, that's probably the one I was considering as well. So
yeah,
if all stars align, I will see you in El Salvador.
Perfect. That would be really cool. And I also consider, like, if I go there, because it's a long flight for me, I will probably be there like 1-2 weeks, because I don't, like, if you just go there and then see the Bitcoin conference and move back, you probably have a not as real of a sight of El Salvador. I really want to be there a little bit earlier or later and see out all the places, maybe rent a car, drive around the country and see the places that are outside of the big cities. And there is, I think, one of my colleagues in Germany, Mark, did it, and he went on his own, completely alone there, and wanted to see everything. Did not want too much help from other Bitcoiners, because he really wanted to experience the country. So will be interesting to see, definitely.
Definitely. I mean, imagine what they're doing there. I did actually some modeling. I think some people will find that interesting. But basically, I see Bitcoin also a little bit of a religion, because it's something that once you I've spent enough time on it, you kind of get integrated, and then you start educating and telling other people about it. It sort of becomes a little bit like a religion, and it's growing at the same pace also as the bigger religions have done in the past. Actually, you could argue it is a religion by those metrics. And it's interesting to see basically what's happening with like the first country that basically seems to really manifest it as, maybe that would become Jerusalem. What Jerusalem is for Christianity, maybe El Salvador will be for the Bitcoin religion.
That would be great. I mean, our Bitcoin Maxi, Max Kaiser and Stacy are already there, so it could be a good story. And a lot of Bitcoiners are actually there. I think one of my colleagues, also Lina Seiche from the Little Bitcoin Hodler, she moved around always in her life, and now she's kind of settling down in El Salvador. So there's a lot of interesting trends going on. We have an end routine in the podcast where the previous guest is asking a question for the next guest. And your question from the previous guest is, what is the best argument you heard against Bitcoin?
The fact that transactions, like number of sheer transactions, is not increasing at the same pace as price itself, that it becomes a potential hodler economy where everyone is just holding their coins. Block rewards will diminish every 4 years. Miners will be dependent on fees, but if no one is basically transacting, there will be also a smaller and smaller fee payments paid out to the miners, which are essentially those securing the network.
Definitely. This is also the most legit, and this is also interesting because when you think about Bitcoin so much and then you see the biggest proponents of Bitcoin, like and Peter Schiff, and you hear him talk and you're like, there's no valid argument in there. But Bitcoiners actually have really interesting arguments. And I love the saying that Bitcoiners are the best critics of Bitcoin, actually.
I think so. Peter Schiff is a, let's get on that on record too. Peter Schiff is a horrible critic of Bitcoin. I used to love him for his macro takes. I also adore him for his takes on gold and all of his viewpoints on the fiat economy. But man, am I tired to hearing him beating up a dead horse with the same Bitcoin arguments. And I cannot believe he's having the airtime in this industry that he's having. Like, why are you featuring this gentleman? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think he has a meme status at this point. And the longer you are in Bitcoin, the more you get bored and dead of him because you're like, I don't like to hear him. And I also like to hear him a lot in the beginning. I think he was at the second or third video that I heard about Bitcoin. It was a debate with him. I don't even remember with whom he debated.
The old one with him and Eric.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yes. This is the debate one. So I got Orange Pill kind of by that video a lot because it teached me about sound money because before I was a stock investor and then I got into like, what's the value of gold? What's the value of Bitcoin? It has no cash flow. So like this, teach me that. Yeah, perfect. Then thank you for being on. Thank you for taking the time. It was a real pleasure talking with you. Before I let you go, is there anything you want to shout out? Is there any way or what is the best way for people to get in touch with you and ask you questions?
I mean, my Twitter handle is a good thing. I mainly tweet about Bitcoin, price development, trends I see in the market, some stupid joke takes sometimes, and then generally what's happening in the fintech and technology space. Was a pleasure participating, Robin. Hope to see you in El Salvador. And before I leave, I should also post my question to the next participant, I suppose.
Yes, I usually do this offline, but you can also do it online if you want.
Ah, okay. Okay, that's great. I will have some more pondering about what question I will ask then.
Yeah, it's like I thought about doing this while recording, but then I was like, I want to give the guest a little bit thinking time before he gives his question, because then I felt like maybe the quality of questions is a little bit better. But yeah,
let's go with that. The world has not enough high quality questions. There are too many questions are shallow, and if better questions were framed, more understanding and better answers can be given.
Very good. Then thank you for the time, Ulrich.
Yeah, please. Cheers.